From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Haseeb Al-Khozai, Managing Editor of VOA's Extremism Watch Desk. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Farah Pandit, author of the new book, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Farah Pandit is a world-leading expert and pioneer in countering violent extremism. She served as a political appointee under Presidents George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, and she was the first ever special representative to Muslim communities, serving both Secretaries Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. Hence, she has the rare distinction of being a political appointee for two Republican presidents and a Democratic president, Barack Obama. Currently, she's a senior fellow at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government, as well as a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. In her new book, How We Win, Farah states that even though the United States has spent billions of dollars since 9/11 trying to defeat terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, the so-called Islamic State, also known as Daesh, and other terrorist groups remain a disturbing geopolitical threat. In How We Win, Pandit analyzes the many factors that have contributed to the worsening state of affairs. They include, but aren't limited to, bureaucratic inertia, lack of political will, insufficient financial resources, Saudi Arabia's dubious role in perpetuating a fundamentalist version of Islam, and of course, the role of social media platforms in spreading false narratives and terrorist propaganda. In How We Win, Pandit shares her deep knowledge about the extremist threat and issues a call to arms to government, the private sector, and civil society. She identifies the basic generational phenomena underlying the extremist scourge. It's not economics or conflict within Islam, nor disillusionment with the United States or its policies. Rather, it's a global identity crisis afflicting Muslim youth. Drawing on her visits to 80 countries, hundreds of interviews and focus groups she's conducted around the world, and her high-level experience in the Bush and Obama administrations, Pandit argues for a paradigm shift in our approach to combat extremism. It's an approach that mobilizes the expertise and resources of diplomats, corporate leaders, mental health experts, social scientists, entrepreneurs, local communities, and, most of all, global youth themselves. We had the privilege of talking with Farah Pandit in March 2010, over 9 years ago, when she served as special representative to Muslim communities under the Obama administration. So we're delighted to welcome her back to Press Conference USA to discuss her new book, How We Win. Farah Pandit, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Haseeb Al-Khozai. He's the managing editor of VOA's Extremism Watch Desk.
Happy to be here.
First of all, congratulations on your excellent and timely book. I recently interviewed Nancy Lindborg, the president of the U.S. Institute of Peace, and we were talking about the same issue, that is, despite all the yeoman efforts to counter violent extremism over the past decade or so, and all the kinetic efforts to defeat the so-called Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, that the situation is worse today. What went wrong, in your view?
This book outlines a really challenging threat that we faced on 9/11, where a terrorist organization was out in the world that we had heard about before, but really didn't understand the manifestations of how they recruit. So over the course of the last 20 years, governments and society themselves have had to scale up our knowledge about what it is that's taking place. And so when you ask what's gone wrong, remember that we had to first learn about what they were doing, but then we also had to figure out how do we deal with an ideological war. Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State and other groups like it that use an us versus them ideology are preying upon a very specific demographic of young people around the world. And so today, when we look at the kind of resources we've spent on the soft power, non-lethal approach, what we have learned about where we've put our money with regard to partnering with local solutions on the ground, and what we know can work in terms of getting into the minds of young people, we have not gone all in. We are still having conversations that are limited in scope and are not backed up with the kind of resources and attention and leadership we need.
So far, at what point did you realize that the crux of the problem had to do more with a global identity crisis afflicting Muslim youth than really any other factor that we normally associate with this problem, whether it's brainwashing, poverty, ignorance, and so forth? A global identity crisis.
One of the things that has been really challenging is that you have policymakers in capitals all over the world that opine about what they think must be the motivators to get a young person to join a horrific group like a so-called Islamic State or an Al-Qaeda. And, you know, we've gotten it wrong. Unless you talk to young people who are being preyed upon by this ideology, by the groups that are out there, you can't begin to understand what's happening emotionally. Government doesn't do emotion well. We don't know how to analyze and understand what a 16-year-old kid living in Toronto or a 27-year-old kid, young person rather, growing up in Delhi feels. How does it feel to be a Muslim? What has happened since 9/11 that makes them think about their identity in a different way? If you don't ask those questions, you cannot begin to understand what's really going on.
Let me ask you what some of those factors are, because they're very critical. The factors since 9/11 that influence these young people. You talk about the Abu Ghraib tragedy during the occupation of Iraq. There's ignorance of Islam and all kinds of issues.
We have a lot of conflicting things that have been happening in the press all day, every day since 9/11. And for a young person growing up who has a connection to either Islam or something to do with heritage that is Islamic, these young people have grown up under the spotlight. And every single day since 9/11, they have seen the word Islam or Muslim on the front pages of papers, online and offline. And that has had a very profound effect on this generation, both millennials and Generation Z.
Let me turn to my colleague Haseeb for a question or two.
Very interesting topics were raised. At a very macro level, you're talking about how the Muslim youth are faced with identity crisis and how they are preyed upon by militant groups, terrorist groups, extremist groups. And also going back to 2001, how the West responded to the 9/11 tragedy. You know, at times counterterrorism missions were adopted and then the counterinsurgency, they went back and forth. But underneath, at a micro level, you have some that would argue that corruption is playing a role, a sense of justice. People feel like sometimes because of the government's corruption, they have to resort to militant groups. They have to go to terror groups because there they can find the so-called parallel judiciary or the parallel justice. And also poverty could also be one factor that is luring the youth. And it's not only necessarily only about the youth. You see a lot of people that are in their 30s, 40s that show sympathy towards extremism. What's your thought on that?
Well, there are two parts to that, right? One is if you find sympathy to a terrorist organization, and that's one part. Another is, are you able to act on that sympathy? And are you willing to join a terrorist organization and do something violent? Two different, very different things. So what we have found in looking at the young people that have joined the armies of AQ or ISIS or the Taliban or Shabab or Boko, any of these groups that are recruiting young Muslims, we know from the research and from talking to former extremists that the most important trigger for that young person is how they feel about themselves. What do they want to think about as they think about their identity of being Muslim? And what do these organizations say to them to make them feel like that they will belong? There are secondary tier two and tier three factors that contribute to the way in which a young person decides to join a group. But the immediate, the affinity, the decision to get on a plane or whatever they're going to do to join the so-called Islamic State, that is a very emotional decision to be able to move in that direction. And I think it's important that we understand that identity crisis and we own it, because I think if you don't have that perspective of a global phenomenon that's not happening for a region, but rather for the demographic, you will not be able to connect the dots on why a young person in Trinidad and Tobago and the Maldives and Tajikistan and Kuala Lumpur, all who are millennials, decide that the so-called Islamic State is something that they want to belong to.
Which is interesting. You talked about, you know, in your book, you talked about how former extremists could be utilized to de-radicalize or bring, you know, to be extremists back into the society. You might face some opposition. Certain societies, particularly in the West, may not feel comfortable even accepting those who were radicalized. Right now, we have a situation where the Syrian Democratic Forces have a hold of dozens of Americans, you know, European nationals in their custody, and nobody knows what to do with them. So the notion that, you know, former extremists would be utilized to educate people and prevent them from joining terrorism or showing sympathy or leniency towards extremism, do you think that could be institutionalized at some point?
We have market tested the content of former extremists and how that plays upon their peer group. The most credible and most authentic message to a young person who's interested in joining a terrorist group is somebody who used to be a terrorist. They find it authentic, they find it credible, they find it real, and they can understand, they believe what that person has done. The way we use that content varies. You can use it in a multitude of ways in an offline and in an online space. I think it is really important to look at the testing models that we've used early on in this crisis in the post 9/11 world of how you take content from former extremists and deploy it so that it interrupts the thinking of a young person who's interested in joining a terrorist group. But I also think, since you're raising the point of the former foreign fighters who had joined ISIS that are now sitting in all these camps that have content that is extremely important. And I think what we should be doing is getting that content, both the men and the women, to hear from them their own stories and using that content so that we can deploy it into society so that others can understand the dangers of joining a group like this. It's a missed opportunity, and no government in the world is doing what they should be doing right now in using that content in a real way.
Talking about authenticity, you are a Muslim from Srinagar, Indian Kashmir. How did your background, how does your background help you in identifying these problems in relating to youth, Muslim youth around the world? I wonder to what extent perhaps it helped to dispel some of their own misconceptions about America.
One of the privileges I have had in my upbringing has been having grown up outside of Boston and being an American, being educated here, understanding what our country is and is not, having the credibility and authenticity to talk about what it means to grow up in America as a Muslim, but to also know that I was an immigrant to this country, that I came here when I was a baby, and that I have connections with family back in India for sure, but that I am an American, and that the American government allowed me to rise and to be at a very senior level in the U.S. government tells a very specific story about who we are as Americans and what we stand for. It allowed me also, I must say, in the way in which I understood communities, having traveled a lot when I was growing up, understanding how important it is to be respectful and give dignity to all voices, that there isn't a hierarchy of who the best Muslim is and who is not the best Muslim, that a Muslim living in Suriname is as Muslim as a Muslim living in Surabaya, and we don't have a cheat sheet on who the most important Muslims are. That allowed me to have open and honest conversations with a wide array of diverse Muslims all over the world, and it opened up the opportunity to have conversations in a way that I think were more accessible because I came to the table with an idea of engagement as opposed to speaking to people. I wanted to hear from them.
We'll have more on that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Farah Pandith. She's the author of the new book, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Hasib Al-Khozai, Managing Editor of VOA's Extremism Watch Desk. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to loyal listener Emil Ohin Braco. He's an engineer from Nigeria who has been listening to PCUSA for over 20 years. Thanks so much for writing in. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to Farah Pandith, our special guest, author of How We Win. Farah, speaking of who's a Muslim, who's not a Muslim, who has the legitimacy, etc., as you said earlier, there's no right or wrong here. But we have the role of Saudi Arabia that is a very important part of your book. And Saudi Arabia sees itself as the standard bearer for Islam. It's the home to the holy sites of Islam. And yet they have been imposing their narrow and fundamentalist version of Islam throughout the world to countries, whether in South Asia, Central Asia, West Africa, in such a way that is distorting those beautiful and very legitimate traditions. How would you describe the role of Saudi Arabia in this whole enterprise, in a sense, radicalizing young people and others?
One of the important parts about the VOA is that you have listeners all over the world. And I traveled to 80 countries when I was special representative to Muslim communities, countries that have had Islam as part of their heritage and communities for hundreds of years. And to a country, every single country I went to, young people and elders would speak to me about the changes that were happening within their culture because of the impact of Saudi Arabia. And this book talks about the system that is underlying extremism. And one of the important planks of that system is the way Saudi Arabia has deployed a very specific strategy over 3 to 4 decades, spending billions of dollars putting forward their version of the way in which you need to be a Muslim, pushing forward the idea that Islam is a monolith, taking away cultural heritage, decimating ancient mosques and churches and cemeteries and replacing it with what they consider to be the right form of Islam. They pay people to dress a particular way. They have textbooks that come into their communities that say very specific things. They talk about an us versus them ideology. They have free Qurans that they have translated in a very peculiar way that they give for free all over the world. Their job has been extremely successful. They have eradicated cultural heritage and made people feel insecure about who they are as Muslims. I thought it was important in this book to talk about what I saw in all of these countries. The chapter is called Plague from the Gulf for a reason. I feel very strongly that 1.6 billion Muslims in the world that are diverse and filled with all kinds of history and heritage have the right to explore who they are without somebody saying to them, you're dressing the wrong way, you're eating the wrong way, you're praying the wrong way, and the way you've been doing something in your country for hundreds of years cannot possibly be true. Please try something else.
So if that's the case, we're in a major dilemma because Saudi Arabia has been considered and is being more so considered in the Trump administration as an important strategic ally against Iran and other threats. So how can we get around this? They have done a lot of damage. I don't know if some of this damage can be undone. There are so many other traditions. I know Morocco is one of those countries that is also trying to train imams. Their tradition, the Maliki tradition, is much more culturally compatible or very much seen as legitimate. But how do we get out of this catch-22?
When you're talking about we, I assume you're talking about the United States?
Mostly.
Well, one of the things that I think is important to remember is that our relationships politically, specifically with a country like Saudi Arabia, is not one-dimensional, first of all. Like China, we can call out very important things that we have problems with, but at the same time trade with them. We can do two things at once. And what I'm calling for in this book is not just for the United States, but for governments around the world and for societies around the world to understand the impact of the the kinds of things that they are doing. I'm not saying don't ever have a relationship with Saudi Arabia, but we can enforce how we believe, as we should, on cultural heritage. We shouldn't allow the decimation of cultural heritage sites around the world. Whether you're Indonesia, whether you're Pakistan, whether you're Morocco, whether you're Norway, you have an opportunity to have a conversation about this global trend that has shifted and changed your population and how they think about being Muslim. And I want to be really clear, whether you're in Sao Paulo as a Muslim or you are in Kano, Nigeria as a Muslim, I have seen the impact of Saudi's strategy. And I think what most people around the world don't understand is it isn't just what's happening in your backyard. It is a cumulative global effect of billions of dollars over decades that has dramatically shifted and changed, which has left us in the situation that we are in today.
Absolutely. I was really struck by some of the examples in your book. Maldives, also we see in Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, being transformed by this Saudi influence when they themselves have beautiful local traditions, Muslim traditions. Let me turn to Haseeb for a question.
So talking about cultural heritage, you also indicated earlier that there is a need for, you know, the lack of a better term, a universal theme to connect the dots, because a Muslim community in Indonesia is no different from a Muslim community elsewhere in the world. They're all Muslims, 1.6 billion. But then the issue of culture also comes into play. You know, there are different traditions. Sometimes it's difficult to tell whether certain practices that are being implemented in those communities are coming from the religion or tradition. So when they intertwine like that, how do you assess the role of culture and tradition when we talk about this overall issue?
Let me be very clear, because I want to make sure your listeners heard me correctly. When I said that there's no difference between a Muslim in Suriname and a Muslim in Surabaya, I meant that the United States government doesn't have the right to say which Muslim is more Muslim. That's what I meant by that statement. Of course, every community in the world has traditions and heritages that impact the way they live their religion out loud. That's true for Christianity, that's true for Judaism, that is also true for Islam. So when I see the interwovenness, if you will, with how culture plays upon a particular society, one of the problems that we have seen is a lot of young people don't know the difference between culture and religion. They don't know what's actually part of the religion and what is actually just a cultural tradition that has been part of their community for hundreds of years. It isn't for the United States government to go around the world talking about religion and how to be a better Muslim. That isn't the role for the U.S. government. But it is important for us to talk about how important it is to give dignity to all of the diversity of expressions of Islam around the world, and not to say that we as the United States believe this kind of Islam is better than that kind of Islam. Or if you are living as a Muslim in Tunisia, you have more right to be a Muslim than a Muslim living in Argentina. That's what I talk about in this book, in terms of how we look at the 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. And importantly, Haseeb, there are a billion Muslims under the age of 30 around the world. And that is the demographic from which the bad guys recruit. And if we don't do more to bolster the diversity of Islam, the bad guys come in and say there is only one way to be Muslim, and that monolithic Islam is the enemy of what it is that we should be doing. This book is about how young Muslims are expressing their identity around the world and why extremists are able to recruit them when we know what they're trying to do and the tools that they use. The idea of the kind of Islam that Saudi puts out and the kind of Islam that Iran puts out is a secondary way of looking at this issue.
And so I want to give our listeners an example of some of the chapter headings. Of course, we talked about the plague from the Gulf, the millennials adrift. But you have a chapter, Halalization and Sheikh Google. Summarize.
One of the phenomenon that I saw happening around the world as kids were understanding their identity shocked me, because I watched them wearing Islam like a lifestyle brand. It wasn't coming from an internal, necessarily, expression of religion, but rather trying to show their peers how they could be more Muslim. And so they would dress a particular way, they would act a particular way, they would do things in a way that were more about the fragility of identity rather than the strength of the identity. I called that chapter halalization because it was the need to be Muslim all day, every day, as you live it out.
Well, let's get to what are some of the solutions. This new paradigm that you talk about, while you were in government, particularly under the Obama administration, you were denied resources. It looked like, you know, you just were spinning wheels in some ways, even though much progress probably had been made. The problem with countering violent extremism is that it's hard to quantify how many people you prevented from turning to extremism. And people like to kill bad guys and say we decimated the Islamic State or whatever. I assume that is a problem. But talk about your prevention efforts and the partners that you say we need.
Governments have had a very problematic time in the last 20 years of understanding what the threat is. You cannot fight a group like the so-called Islamic State or Al-Qaeda if you're only looking at a physical measurement. There's no way of measuring the ideological war. You know that there are things that you need to put into the system, the antibodies that you need to put in the system to make sure that a young person doesn't find this attractive. The measurement stick is not the same as a measurement stick for the physical war. And we've got to stop thinking about this in terms of territory or how many troops are on the table. So the first part has been that problem of what it means to be able to deploy a whole host of different kinds of things offline and online that allow a young person to think differently about who they are.
And you also talk about open power. Define open power.
I feel as though when we have conversations in the 21st century, we are having conversations that are stuck in a different century. Here are the tools in our toolbox. Here is the hard power tools. Here are the specific soft power tools that government can use. I know that we can think differently about the issue of the appeal of this ideology if we open up the aperture, if we think about a networked way of thinking about power. So rather than power over, you're talking about power with. So how do you bring in anthropologists and behavioral psychologists and ethnographers and historians and theologists who can work with you in designing the programs that will make a difference for a young person?
And as we close, Farah Pandit, are you concerned about the era we're living in now? Our current government is sending an anti-immigrant message and other messages which could almost, in a sense, offset any good that could be done through these anti-extremism measures. If this kind of rhetoric continues, whether it's Islamophobia or anti-immigrant sentiment, are we just sort of treading water? We're seeing this around the world, the rise of nationalism, populism. We're also seeing white supremacism on the rise, which statistics show is now actually more than what we're seeing from radical Islamist violence here in the United States.
The world has been lazy on hate. Governments have been lazy, business has been lazy, and regular citizens have been lazy, looking to others to stop the rise of an us versus them. It doesn't matter what kind of hate it is. We're seeing it rise, whether it's anti-Semitism, whether it's against Hindus or Muslims or Christians, whether it's about race or gender, whether it's about heritage or proximity to something else. It is appalling that today, in 2019, we're looking around and seeing all of this kind of poison in our societies and not doing more to stop it from finding a source and a host. So what I believe is that while we must have leaders that talk with dignity about each other, to talk about respect, to debunk an us versus them, we also must see the private sector and regular citizens themselves say, what can we do in our societies to make sure that there is not a rise of hate that includes education programs, that includes the way we raise our children, it includes the way in which we think about every touch point in a community. This is not only from the top down, it is also from the bottom up. And I would urge your listeners, in every community that they live in around the world, neighborhood to neighborhood, what do you stand for? Is it okay to hate? And what can you do yourself, even in a microscopic way, to make sure that hate is not growing where you live?
And question what you read on social media platforms. The book is How We Win, how cutting-edge entrepreneurs, political visionaries, enlightened business leaders, and social media mavens can defeat the extremist threat. The author, Farah Pandith. Farah, thank you for coming in and sharing your precious time and insights, and congratulations once again on your terrific book.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and joining me on the program was Hasib Alkozai, managing editor of VOA's Extremism Watch Desk. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.